Welcome to the Bulwark Friday podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter, and we are joined by the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. By the way, you need to kind of shake that, don't you, Michael Steele? Good to have you back, Michael.
Hey, Charlie, it's always good to be with you, bro. Absolutely. Happy Friday to you.
I've heard you speak, and you always include the line, you know, don't blame me. I didn't do it.
I just want to set the record straight. I'm not responsible for this crazy. I had my own crazy back in the day, but not like this.
So speaking of crazy, it does feel, I was thinking one of the things that makes this seem so difficult to get through, because we've gone through difficult times in American history before.
Sure.
But part of what seems to be going on, maybe it's just the pace of the news cycle, or maybe it's the you don't know what the rules are. There are no guide rules. But, you know, it does seem like everyone's losing their mind. I mean, and that's one of the factors is just the amount of absolute, and by crazy, I don't mean just mean like, hey, that's crazy. I mean, just nuts, insane.
I kind of laugh at it and look at it and go, we're really kind of past the losing the mind part. I mean, I think we're just full blown in crazy. We're just there. And I think it gets reinforced every day by a president and his enablers who go out and purposely, I mean, that this is with, you know, malice aforethought, as far as I'm concerned, put in play various scenarios that disrupt, that are designed to destruct and to confuse people, to make them guess and second guess their own instincts when it comes to our government, our country, our neighbors. And it's I've never seen anything like it. I mean, this is reality TV on steroids.
Okay. That's that's the perfect segue, right? To go into the, you know, one of the most bizarre moments, and we've seen a lot of bizarre moments, but one of the most bizarre moments we've seen in a long time was Rudy Giuliani and his meltdown on CNN last night. And I just want to play a little bit of all of this, because, and I would urge people, if you haven't seen it, you have to go watch all of this. And then listen, this is Rudy Giuliani going on CNN as the story was breaking that the whistleblower complaint has to do with Trump's dealings with Ukraine.
Statement. Was he seen as corrupt or no?
At Joe Biden, who probably is working with half the IQ that you and I have. If you listen to Joe Biden's tape, he convicts himself. He says, I told the president of the Ukraine, if you don't dismiss this guy, you're not going to get your $1.2
billion. All right, so that's what you say Biden said to the Ukraine. Did you ask the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden?
No, actually, I didn't. I asked the Ukraine to investigate the allegations that there was interference in the election of 2016 by the Ukrainians for the benefit of Hillary Clinton, for which there already is a court finding.
You never asked anything about Hunter Biden. You never asked anything about Joe Biden.
The only thing I asked about Joe Biden is to get to the bottom of how it was that Lutsenko, who was appointed,
right,
dismissed the case against Antac.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
No, I didn't ask him to look into Joe Biden. I asked him to look into the allegations that related to my client, which tangentially involved Joe Biden in a massive bribery scheme.
Rudy.
Not unlike
Rudy.
What he did in China.
Rudy.
You explained to me how the kid got $1.5 billion
Rudy,
from China.
I have no problem with Biden you launching allegations, but just be careful about what you say. I asked you, did
I
you ask Ukraine to look at Joe Biden? You said no. Then
I
you went on to say that you did.
Okay, so Michael Steele, the big question is that pure crazy or crazy like a fox? There are people who are saying, look, this is what he does. This is what Rudy Giuliani does. He goes on, he throws up lots of smoke, lots of dust, you know, tries to deflect the attention. And frankly, he's been very effective. In fact, Margaret Taylor tweeted from Lawfare, you know, look, he's not doing it because he's insane. This is how he protects the president. You concede the conduct occurred, then you obfuscate and confuse to take the sting out. And he's done this before for Trump, and actually quite effectively.
Yeah, that's part of the play. They have figured out, and again, Charlie, this goes to something that I've been saying now for 3 years, and The media is as much to blame as this as the rest of us are, in the sense that people still, for whatever reason, believe, think, hope, feel, expect this president to be like Obama, to be like Bush. In other words, that office of the presidency somehow makes us look at him as if he's like any other president. He is not. This has never been part of his makeup. I asked the question during the inaugural week back in 2017. The test for me would be whether or not the presidency would change Donald Trump or Donald Trump would change the presidency, because that was the battle. Because Trump was coming into this with an idea that he would not be constrained. And in fact, there's some great reporting out right now that talks about how given that Trump, what he's been able to do, everybody's acting around him. There's no one with any real responsibility, with no one with any real authority. He is the government. He is the central focus. So Rudy Giuliani going on CNN last night was part of that continuing narrative that if something bobbles up, then we'll go out and we'll put a cloud around it. We'll confuse the public about it. We'll say the press is, again, exercising their fake news authority and get past it. But this, I think, has more to it than that and potentially could be damaging. I mean, I was laughing. The president just now with the prime minister of Australia was talking about, well, you know, I don't know the identity of the whistleblower, but I've been told that it is a partisan person. Well, number one, your administration does know, and so do you. And number two, you weren't told that it's a partisan person. But this is, again, creating this space, Charlie, so that when whatever is revealed by this whistleblower, their identity, what they have to say, the public consumes it in a way in which it's like, well, okay, that's not true. Or, yeah, I already know that. This is an old story. And that's the effect of what you saw last night.
Or what he's basically saying is, yeah, he did it, and so what? He has the right to do it. He did exactly what he's being accused of. And it worked. It's sort of a reprise of when Rudy Giuliani went through, there's no collusion. But if there was collusion, there's nothing wrong with it. It's completely okay.
Exactly. That's exactly right. This is the space we've been in. I mean, it is maddening to me to listen to people, and particularly, you know, very smart, capable men and women in the press stand there and take this drivel from this man, and then, you know, treat it with some degree of dignity. So, for example, in that same scene at the White House a little while ago with the prime minister, when the president says to all of the reporters gathered there that the American press is a laughingstock around the world, no one likes you. The next question, if I'm a reporter in the room, would have been, excuse me, Mr. Prime Minister, the president of the United States just said we're a laughingstock around the world. Do you agree with that? How do Australians look at the American press? That's the moment. Yeah, you may get kicked out of the room, but now you've exposed the sheer lying insanity of this administration. And no one takes those moments and say, damn it, I've been doing this my whole life. I'm not going to let you sit here and denigrate my livelihood and legitimate journalism because you're afraid of getting caught in your foolishness.
I understand that. On another level, though, I mean, isn't the lying insanity sort of baked into the cake? I mean, we kind of know this. This is not new. I mean, how many times do you need to say it? So here's my question about this whole whistleblower story. I mean, those of us who've lived, through, all of this, know that this story could either be a really, really big deal, or it could be overhyped. It could turn out to be nothing. It could be a big deal, and it will be ignored. Nobody will care about it. So, I mean, I'm trying to break down whether this is anything new, because, the Washington Post broke the story last night that this is Ukraine, and this has already been under investigation, whether Trump and his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, sought to manipulate the Ukrainian government into helping Trump's reelection campaign. This is kind of breathtaking. Now, they had actually put that in an editorial a couple of days ago. We are reliably told the president has a second and more venal agenda. He is attempting to force Mr. Zelensky, the president, to intervene in the 2020 U.S. presidential election by launching an investigation of the leading Democratic candidate, Joe Biden. Mr. Trump is not just soliciting Ukraine's help with his presidential campaign. He is using U.S. military aid the country desperately needs in an attempt to extort it. Now, then Rudy Giuliani is basically saying, yeah, but so what? He says a president telling a president-elect of a well-known corrupt country he better investigate corruption that affects U.S. is doing his job. Maybe if Obama did that, the Biden family wouldn't have bilked millions from Ukraine and billions from China being covered up by a corrupt media. So I read these stories, the first tranche of the story, and I think this is a huge deal. This is the collusion. This is the conspiracy. This is really betraying his role. This is not only impeachable. This is the sort of thing that justifies removal. And then you read the way it is being spun as, you know, nothing to see here. So is this going to be different, or is it going to be playing out in the same sort of gavotte that we've seen over and over and over again?
I think we're going to have gavotte for days. I think in the end, Charlie, as god awful as it is, or potentially could be, I think you're looking at an inept Democratic party in the House, particularly. They can't seem to figure out whether it wants to go, stop, or just, you know, sit still. You've got a Republican leadership that is checked out. It's not all but checked out. It is totally gone.
Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. And that leaves Trump to just kind of do whatever Trump wants to do. I mean, you know, we have this thing called the Emoluments Clause, and the Attorney General says, hell, I'm going to have a $30,000 party at the president's hotel. And everybody goes and goes, okay. You know, we lock kids in cages, and people kind of wring their hands, and everybody goes, okay, well, let's wait till the next thing happens. And then there are not one but two shootings in the same state within a matter of weeks. And everybody's like, oh, my God, we got to do gun control. The president, yeah, we'll take a look at that at some point. Never. So how is this going to, when you put this in the context of everything else that we should have been outraged about, that should have been in a, quote, impeachable offense, where does this sit? And
okay.
Then if you figure out where it sits, what are you going to do about it?
Okay, so here's a question for you. Why is this happening? Okay, we'll get back to that. It's above our pay grade. No, but I do agree
hey,
with
Charlie,
you. I feel like I've lived through. Yeah, okay.
I was going to say, look, I got my answer to that question is why I do G&T at 10. That's a gin and tonic at 10 a.m. Because by that time, after all the Trump tweets and all the silly reposts to the tweets, I just kind of go, okay, let me take a gin and tonic and chill. And then I can get on with the rest of the day. That's how you deal with it.
Does it work? Does a gin and tonic work? I mean,
it does for me, baby.
I'm seriously thinking about that. This would be a good year to take up day drinking. I've generally had this thing, nothing before 5 o'clock, but I'm thinking, is day drinking really a bad thing? Is it? I mean, is it?
Yes. You know, can it be worse than this?
I'm looking for good life choices. Well, I was writing something really early this morning about, you know, it's the corruption stupid, you know, that we have devoted all of this attention, which I think legitimately, to collusion, to obstruction of justice, when the real
right.
vulnerability is just this old-fashioned graft. And it's interesting that you run through the list of investigations. The New York Times actually has this graphic, and it's 29 different investigations, federal, state, and local, congressional investigations. And a lot of it is pretty easy to understand. It is the president of the United States using his office to put money in his pocket, actually, you know,
right.
influence peddling, but also taking money from taxpayers and diverting it into his own pocket. This is easy to explain to people in Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, wherever.
Right.
We're not using words like emoluments, but we are at this moment where it is difficult to get anyone to take a position. Okay, so you mentioned a lot of this. Just part of the frustration is you do feel like you're in this Groundhog Day cycle. I'm also writing a piece, and maybe you can help me on this, on Ben
sure.
Sasse. And Ben Sasse, and going through everything that Ben Sasse has written and said about the president, and he is, and just for my, you just cut me some slack here. He is the, you know, one, among the better, the best and the brightest. You know, he was the guy that you would hope would be the conscience of the party.
Right.
He wrote books, you know, about the culture, about our politics. He had been willing to call out the president during the campaign and during his presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier this year, he basically completely surrendered, voted to uphold the president's emergency order on the border, and then has gone completely silent, absolutely silent. And then, of course, last week he got what he wanted. He got the tweet of endorsement. And it's I do get the political self-preservation, the instinct.
But I don't anymore.
You don't.
Don't.
Tell me why you don't get it anymore.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't, because I think it's a bunch of bull at this point. You don't. It's like what evangelicals have done over the last 40 years. Preach a bunch of, you know, holier than thou BS, telling us how to live, who to love, what to do, what not to do. And then in this moment, because they found a guy who's going to give them a Supreme Court justice that they like, or a tax cut that they won't actually benefit from, they're willing to suppress their judgmental behavior of this one man as they have judged everyone else. So I have nothing to do with them. Ben Sasse, I've admired from the very beginning, and I've got to watch him up close and personal. And you started the conversation in the same way I looked at Ben at the time, was this is a guy of principle. This is a guy who gets what this fight is about. This is a guy who's willing to stake the claim. Oh, until it was time to get friggin' reelected. And then what did he do? He shut up. He said nothing. He voted the, quote, right way, because he wanted that tweet. He wanted that endorsement, because he valued his reelection more than the principle he was standing on, the principle he preached to the rest of us and told us to follow him on, to get behind him on, that he would lead on. Oh, but wait a minute. I got to get reelected first. No, you stand on that principle and you fight on that principle. And if you lose the job, then that would have been a principled loss. And the rest of us can look at that and go, damn it, this is why the fight is worth it. But these folks, when they value what their office they hold more than the people they represent, than the history and the principles and the ideals of the party that they're in, then what's the point? Don't say anything. Now, once you get reelected, don't go back. What are you going to do now? When Trump does the next bit of crazy, you're forced to stay silent.
Yeah.
You can't say anything.
And that is the cycle. So with a guy like Ben Sasse,
so what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, I understand.
And I feel like, don't get me wrong.
No, I still
like Ben. So Ben, if you're listening,
I do too.
I still like you. But brother, please don't start talking to me about principles and Trump and getting all upset when Trump does the next bit of crazy. You know what? Don't please just stay silent, because That's the bargain you've made.
I mean, he was posed.
That's the bargain
he was made. He was poised to be one of the intellectual leaders of the conservative movement.
Yeah,
and I
was ready.
And maybe he will be able to recover this. But I mean, this is the loss of guys like Paul Ryan and Ben Sasse. It's not just that they made the compromises in their roles. It's the future that they mortgaged as well. Okay, so another question about Ben. I mean, I understand, you know, that the base is very, very intolerant of, I mean, very, very supportive of Donald Trump. I get that. So if he had, along with 13 other Republican senators, voted to overturn the president's emergency order and made his stand on constitutional principle, would the primary voters in Nebraska really have rejected him if he stood up and said it would be wrong for the president of the United States to use his power to get to force a foreign government to engage in, you know, to, you know, come up with compromise on his opponent to help him in the 2020 election? Would Nebraska voters have thrown him out of office if he spoke up about that? And I you know, maybe things are worse than
they
I think.
Have.
So he made some of these compromises unnecessarily. Okay, so Michael Steele, I want to talk to you about what's going on with the Republican primaries And I want to talk to you about what the Democrats are doing. But we'll do this right after a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, B-U-L-W-A-R-K, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, we're back with Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. Okay, by the way, what is the statute of limitations on being called that before we go back to Michael Steele, well-known political pundit? You know what I'm saying? I mean, don't you have to scrub that at some point? I mean, aren't you tired of that?
You just roll with it.
Okay.
That's what you do. You just roll with it.
So let's talk about the Republic as the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. It's interesting to me how many Republicans are right now, Republican state parties are in the process of abolishing their primaries or their caucuses because they don't want to let Republican voters decide who the nominee is going to be. Look, it's going to be Donald Trump, almost certainly.
Right.
So the question is,
what are you afraid of?
Exactly. So what are they afraid of? What are they afraid of?
They're afraid of the embarrassment of having a portion of the Republican primary elector come out and vote against the president, vote for someone else. They want to continue promoting the illusion that there is unanimity among rank and file Republicans about this president. What you have seen is something that is unprecedented. The RNC has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump campaign, which is problematic for the gentlemen who are in or considering getting into the Republican primary, because they're allowed to have access to resources of the RNC just like any other candidate running for the presidency. Donald Trump, just for the record, everybody should know and understand, is president. That's one role. When he files papers and declares his candidacy for office as an incumbent, he is a candidate. He's no different than anyone else who files papers for that same office. He has no greater value. He has no greater power or control over the process because he is the incumbent. Yes, now there is the power of incumbency to the extent that he can raise more money probably. And more people will say, I'm with him as opposed to this guy over here. That's fine. But as far as the political infrastructure of the party, he has no more greater access to that infrastructure than any other primary candidate.
Well, that's the way it should be.
Until such time as he's a
right.
That's the way it should. That's the way it's always been.
But that's not the way it
is
now.
That's the way it's always been. That's not the way it is now. What you're seeing is a wholesale lockdown of GOP by the Trump campaign and operatives inside the party itself, inside the RNC, members of the 168, to avoid any particular challenge to this president. Reince Priebus started this in the 2016 cycle by changing the rules so that you could not have floor debate. There could not be a floor challenge, which is something that Ted Cruz and others were looking at in 2016. And so the party's been on lockdown. this process has been now completed with the full Trumpification of the party, both politically as well as philosophically. And here we are. So, yeah, these guys are going to have a hard time making their way through some of this primary states, because states like South Carolina and others are saying, you know what, we're just not going to have a primary at all.
Well, and of course, this is ironic, because you have a former governor of South Carolina, a former congressman from South Carolina, somebody who, before he had some other political problems, had actually been talked about as a potential candidate for president or vice president.
Mm-hmm.
He is running against Donald Trump, and the South Carolina Republican Party basically says, yeah, there's nothing to see here. We're not even going to allow people to vote. I mean, it is ugly.
Yeah.
Now, you and I have talked about this before, and so people who might remember that, or maybe this is the first time, but I remember having this conversation with Reince Priebus during 2016, asking, isn't there a separate Republican Party from the Trump campaign, and isn't there good reasons to have a Republican Party that has congressional candidates running, Senate candidates running, candidates mm-hmm. in all 50 states running, to have a separate agenda and a separate identity? Do you have to go all in on Donald Trump? And he was making the case, basically, that no, there's really no choice, that, you know, once somebody, you know, gets close to the nomination, we have to be all in on that. And of course, now that seems to be on absolute steroids, that the Republican Party has no existence, has no mind that is separate from the Trump high command. I mean, they are now the id of the Trump campaign, or the Trump campaign is the id of the RNC.
Right. Well, let's deal with the first part. Reince is wrong. Unless and until you become the nominee of the Republican Party, we are not all in on you until you go through the convention process, because before you change the rules, that process had the potential to allow for someone else to emerge who could put together the requisite delegates and states if they wanted to start a floor fight, because they thought the fight for the nomination was that important. That was something that Republicans at one time always adhered to. And so you didn't see, going back to the 1976 election with Gerald Ford being challenged by Ronald Reagan, that the Reagan forces were trying to put together the appropriate floor fight to challenge the nomination. They brought in Paul Manafort, and Paul Manafort didn't go changing the rules. What they did was they worked within the system to cut their deals, as you're supposed to do with the relevant states and delegates, to keep the vote from happening. That's all legitimate. That's part of the process. That should be allowed to happen. So there was no all-in by the Republican National Committee in 1976 to protect Gerald Ford. What the hell is he talking about, all-in? So that gives you some idea of how warped this process has become under Trump, how this man has been able to literally mind meld people into a space that is wholly irrational to the body politic is amazing to me. And the rest of us, guys like you and me, we're sitting here scratching our collective heads going, what the hell happened to these people? I mean, we were once having a national rational conversation on policy, and we had a stage of 15 people made up of governors and senators, all legitimate candidates to run for the presidency of the United States. This was the best bench we had ever put together.
I thought,
and then
I
we watched.
Okay, so here's a question, though. The question, because I ask all the time, what the hell happened? After the mm-hmm. mid-morning GNT, does it become clearer? Or we just not care anymore?
You know, it gets clearer. I'll be honest with you. It gets clearer for me, Charlie. It really does. I mean, you know, I like you, have a history with Trump. And so, you know, couple that with everything I've known before this crazy, and then taking into consideration everything that's happening now, you are a little bit more clear-eyed. You have to be. Someone has to be. the country can't afford to have all of us put these damn blinders on and ignore the realities of the Constitution and what we're doing to other human beings.
I think we need to have another podcast. We need to have the post-morning GNT podcast. We have to have the day-drinking podcast. I think that would be absolutely... I think it'd be outstanding. You know, what's also interesting is how obsessed Trump was with, you know, saying that the system was rigged against him. It's rigged against him. Mm-hmm. And once he gets into power, of course, that's his agenda, is literally to rig the system. And it's
to
a reminder of how much that comes out of Trump's mouth is projection, is how he accuses other people of doing, in fact, what he is doing. So give me your sense of this Republican field. You have Bill Weld, you have Mark Sanford, you have Joe Walsh. Thoughts about that?
All right, so let's start with the good governor of Massachusetts, Weld, who is very smart, capable, successful governor of a blue state, and I think under any other circumstances would be someone that folks in the party would be proud to have out there running and talking to the country about, again, those values, ideas, and policies that certainly were successful while he was governor and could be made successful for the country. His problem is, you know, charisma, ability to connect people, that is not a strong suit right now for him. And it's kind of gotten overshadowed just by events. Right. And so he's there. He's persistent. He's diligent, but has not been able to create the kind of traction by himself. Enter the other two. So now you have Joe Walsh coming into the table. I had Joe Walsh on my podcast a few weeks ago, and I asked him straight up. I've known Joe Walsh was part of helping the team, helping him get elected back in 2010. And asked him, I said, dude, the guy then and the guy that you became were two very different people. And I need to understand as a black man, how you can say and do racist things and not be a racist. So that whole conversation right there tells you it doesn't really matter what Joe Walsh is about, because the baggage is so great around his clear promotion of white nationalistic language and attitudes makes it untenable and delegitimizes the effort. But I get why he's doing it. He's had a revelation about Trump, and now here we are. Mark Sanford is interesting.
No, I agree with that. I appreciate the fact that he's, you know, he's jumped off the sinking ship, but that doesn't mean he gets to be the captain of the ship. And, you know, right. I welcome him to the resistance, but you are right. I do think that some of the things that he has done and said are, in fact, disqualifying, and particularly disqualifying for a movement that is appalled by Donald Trump's behavior. So how do you run against
right.
Donald Trump by basically embracing the DNA of Trumpism? And I say that reluctantly, because I like Joe Walsh and I like a lot of the things he's saying. But I don't know that you can really make the distinction that he's trying to make between all of the racist things that he has said and done and say, but that doesn't mean that I am a racist. Okay, well, you know,
right.
That's fine, but we need to have a little more distance between that and making you president of the United States. So,
And as to modify the saying, people may or may not tell you who they are, but invariably they will show you who they are. And I think that's part of his problem. And finally, with Sanford, Mark is intriguing. Mark is intriguing because Mark is the only one who has been consistent in his antagonism of Trumpism, particularly along fiscal and economic policy wise. He has been from the very beginning, certainly as a governor and as a member of the House, a fiscal hawk. He's been very strong about Republican spending money of the American people that they don't have to spend, creating debts and deficits. And while he was in the House, challenged the administration on ratcheting up debt and deficit for various things. So he can make the economic argument. He can actually come at Trump from a policy position, Now, Trump wants to sidebar him with the whole, oh, yeah, this is the guy who was having an affair in the woods. Okay, sort of deal. I think for many people, yeah, that's, you know, that's beyond pot calling kettle black. I'm like, dude, really? You're gonna go toe to toe with a guy and sort of castigate him for an affair that he had once? Oh, can we talk about the three plus that you've had? And so it doesn't work out the same way for Trump with Sanford. Sanford's challenge is one, making the definitive move into the race and doing it in a bold way. Two, if I were him, I would challenge my home state of South Carolina for the action that they've taken to block, to not have the primary. That, fine, won't do anything from South Carolina, but around for the other 49 states, yeah, that could create some really good noise for him. So he poses an interesting, for me at least, an interesting question mark about the race. And the ability to get in and to effectively challenge Trump from not the right, but from the center right, from that sort of economic space where, you know, we're going to be looking at the economy and how it's going to be performing first, second quarter next year. And certainly, you know, by the end of this year, we're already talking $1 trillion worth of deficit. So no one's talking about that inside the GOP because, God forbid, we actually call out the fact that we're the ones who did it.
You know, I would, of course, prefer to have a much higher profile challenge, you know, whether it would be at one time I would have thought Nikki Haley or somebody like Carly Fiorina or somebody like Jim Mattis. But right now, at least you do have this the three horsemen who give right. Anti-Trump voters at least, you know, some option. So, you know, if you want, you know, Tea Party Trumpism, you can vote for Joe Walsh. If you want a more moderate establishment Republicanism, you can vote for Bill Weld. If you want the center-right fiscal conservatism, there's Mark Sanford. And I do think that there is the remote possibility that in a state like New Hampshire, you might get enough votes to pierce that image of you know, invulnerability of Trump. Let's talk about the Democrats, because the other day I was talking with Dave Jolly, former Congressman Dave Jolly, who right now is kind of high on Elizabeth Warren's electability. And I have to say, I'm not getting, I'm not feeling it. I'm not seeing
it. I'm buying that Kool-Aid. Sorry.
Okay. And I want to play something for you. Because it's interesting that we're at the stage of the campaign and you're talking about the debate. And the Democrats actually are now starting to have a substantive debate. And Pete Buttigieg is out with a health care plan and he's taking direct shots at Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, saying, you know what, Medicare for all should not mean taking away people's private health insurance. You know, that is a bad idea. It's not just, you know, an unpopular idea. It is a bad idea.
Right.
And he's also, and other, you know, folks are beginning to notice that Elizabeth Warren will not do what Bernie Sanders has done and admit that this massively expensive health care plan will raise taxes on the middle class. And weirdly enough, she got asked tough questions about this by Stephen Colbert. Let's just play that.
Yeah.
You keep being asked in the debates, how are you going to pay for it? Are you going to raise the middle class taxes?
Right.
How are you going to pay for it? Are you going to raise the middle class taxes?
So here's how we're going to do this. Costs are going to go up for the wealthiest Americans, for big corporations.
Taxes, which is what you mean by cost?
Yeah. Okay. And hardworking middle class families are going to see their costs go down.
But will their taxes go up?
Well, but here's the thing.
Here's the thing. I've listened to these answers a few times before, and I just want to make a parallel suggestion for you about how you might defend the taxes that perhaps you're not mentioning in your sentence.
Okay, so that's kind of awkward that even Stephen Colbert is going, hey, well, you just won't say it. And so I'm just you're not drinking the Elizabeth Warren Kool-Aid.
Heck no. No. Look, I give Elizabeth Warren props for what she's been able to do. She weathered the Pocahontas storm from Trump. She weathered that very well. In fact, weathered it so effectively that she bounced back to the point where it's not part of the political conversation with her. She has done a very, I think, interesting Trumpian kind of thing, and that shifted the discussion to, I've got a plan for that. So now everyone is sort of digging into all the plans that Elizabeth Warren had. Here's the problem. Those plans cost something. those plans have a price tag to them. And it was interesting to me about Mayor Pete's broadside was how clever, precise, non-personal, effective it was, which tells me, the tell is, the next debate, Elizabeth Warren's got an X on her. She's got a mark on her. And as we saw, the early tells were candidates were kind of saying, oh, this about Biden and that about Biden. You got to debate. They unloaded on Biden. Now you've watched this begin for Elizabeth Warren. She is the target because everybody else now realizes the separation that has occurred between Biden and Warren and them. And so it's looking more like a two-headed race as opposed to a 7 or 8 person headed race. And folks want to get their head in the mix there. And so they're going to come after her. She has not. In the last debate, the senator was asked not once but 4 times, Charlie, whether or not her plan would lead to raising taxes on the middle class. And she averted that answer. She moved away from it. She danced, tiptoed, tattooed, all that, never addressed it, and continues to do so. At some point, I suspect it'll be Mayor Pete in the next debate. Standing there next to her, looking at her, saying, I asked you for the 4th time, will middle class America pay for this? And the answer is yes, they have to.
Well,
because there's not enough money you're going to get from rich people to pay for this.
Well, her argument is that the middle class will end up paying less because you won't be paying your health care costs. So you that's so the debit side. You may be paying more in taxes, but it's interesting. I had a conversation with
you may be paying more in taxes, but your health. So let me get this straight. So my health care premiums go down,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
But my taxes go up.
Correct.
Which means I'm going to be bringing home less money, even though I'm getting the, quote, benefit of a lower health care premium. My premium goes down from $1,000 to maybe $800, but my taxes go up such that $200 savings is not realized. What are you telling me?
Well,
what is she saying to us?
Well, that's the question, because we don't know. And as I was talking with a very progressive Democrat about this, and she was making an interesting point. She said, so I get my health care paid through my employer, and they pay, you know, the vast majority of it, you know, maybe, you know, 80% mm-hmm. of the cost. So under this plan, you know, this company will save all of that money. Am I supposed to believe now that they're going to give me that in salary? Because they get the savings.
Right.
What do I actually get? I'm going to have to pay the taxes.
Oh my God.
But so people are calculating this. And this is the thing for the tens of millions of Americans who have employer-based insurance. They think, number one, I'm going to lose that. And number two, so
right.
when the cost goes away, the savings goes to my boss, who is not going to share that with me, or at least not 100% of that.
No.
But I might get hit by taxes, and there's no transparency here. And look, you've been in politics for a very, very long time. You know what $1 billion worth of Republican ads are going to do to Elizabeth Warren on that issue.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, it's just the ads write themselves. And you don't have to run a lot of them. You can just run that ad just like 4 times in the second year. People get that message. They know that reality very well. People appreciate this one truth. They will realize the benefit of Elizabeth Warren's plan relative to the point you were just saying, my employer is going to pass on all of these great savings to me, just as that same employer passed along all those great service savings he got from the tax cut just imposed. Oh no! What he did was he reinvested it in the company, reinvested in his stock and for his shareholders. He did not reinvest it in his personnel, in the people who work for him. Didn't cut their costs of doing business, if you will. In fact, they didn't see any of that. So what makes you think that an employer is going to realize, let's say, $1 billion across the entire business spectrum, employers are going to realize $1 billion in savings, and they're going to go, you know what? We're going to share that with our employees by, you know, increasing their wages and augmenting their health care to offset any residual impact from Elizabeth's plan.
Yeah, good luck selling that. By the way, just sort of on a side note, I noticed this Bloomberg piece that points out this $28 billion bailout of the farmers because of Trump's trade war. That $28 mm-hmm. billion, that farm bailout is more than twice as expensive as the 2009 bailout of Detroit's big three automakers, which cost taxpayers $12 billion. I don't know about you. I'm old enough to remember when that was a big deal and very, very controversial, and conservatives were just absolutely outraged at spending.
They were losing it over Trump. I mean, not Trump, over Bush. For even, you know, at the end of his administration, sort of, quote, getting together with the Obama people to come up with, you know, all of these this financial fix. And then, of course, Obama sort of putting the icing on the cake with the bailout of GM. The $12 billion. And the difference was GM paid it back. Who's going to pay back this $28 billion? Farmers aren't going to pay that money back. We're not going to see that money again. That's gone. And if you didn't have a tariff in place in the first place, you wouldn't have to. What does it say, Charlie, that I'm going to impose a tariff on a country like China and you're going to lie to the American people, one, by saying it's not a tax on them, and two, by saying that they're going to benefit roundly from it, and then have to come up with a boondoggle to save corporate farms. And remember, we're talking that $28 billion, 85% of that was for corporate farms. That didn't go to the small mom and pop farms in Iowa and Nebraska and even here in Maryland. That went to the big corporate farming institutions. That's who got saved on that. So what does it say that you now have to spend that money on top of everything else? The tariffs don't work.
And what does it say that the Tea Party, such as it is completely in on this? All in. Totally.
All in.
All in.
All
okay.
In, baby.
So, Michael Steele, I think it is time for that midday GNT. At least it is here in Wisconsin. So again, thank you so much.
Dude, what do you think I've been doing during this conversation?
You know what? I'm jealous. I'm feeling jealous already. So thanks for joining me again, Michael. Appreciate it very much.
Always my pleasure, Charlie. Always.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by ZipRecruiter. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.